A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is the Hip Hop Saved My Life podcast. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Hope you enjoy the podcast. Now sit back, because it's time for the podcast.
Welcome to Hip Hop Saved My Life. We are delighted. Well, Roomage is here, I should say that.
Hello, just Roomage, just about.
You've had a bit of a nightmare, haven't you?
Yeah, I came off my moped on the way here.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. I think I might have broken my left wrist. We'll see.
How it pans out. So you've broken your wrist before, haven't you?
Yeah.
And what happened last time?
I just slept on it overnight and the pain got worse and worse, which is happening with this one.
Is it happening?
Yeah. I think so.
Was it the other wrist or the same one?
No, this is a new one.
Shit, so you think you've broken it?
I don't know. It's getting
I'm slightly
worse.
Concerned about the green stuff coming out of it at the moment.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's normal.
Okay, well, if you feel like you're going to pass out or
yeah,
whatever,
keep an eye on me.
It's going to be barely noticeable, so I think it's fine. Yeah.
It's good for the ratings, though.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, it's great.
And I'm dead in the follow-up.
Yeah.
In the next record.
If we all pass out, you know, it could be interesting.
Are you feeling okay, though?
Yeah, I feel good.
Okay, great. Yeah. Listen, we are absolutely delighted to be joined by the legendary James Lavelle. Hello, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you.
Founder of Mowax, founder of Uncle, and just general... I was about to say all-round bad man, but I don't think that's...
Have you ever had that in an intro before?
Those days are over, man. I put a full stop on it with that documentary, goddammit. I'm like the Godfather 3, you know, I try and get away and they just drag me back.
Yeah. We were just talking about films before we started recording, and my film experience was Avengers Infinity War, but you've just seen two, like...
Yeah, I just saw Roma last night,
right,
which won Venice, which is just extraordinary.
Yeah.
And the week before I saw Cold War, which are both quite similar sort of styles, black and white, very beautiful, and just these sort of incredible stories about life and love and etc. But both leave a lot to the imagination, which is quite nice.
When you watch a film like that, do you have popcorn?
I didn't have popcorn yesterday. I'm not a big popcorn person. I usually sort of get loads of sort of cola bottles and stuff, and then I've eaten them by the time the film starts.
The pick and mix at the cinema. Sorry, you're talking beautifully about the film, but I am just slightly distracted.
You weren't listening.
I was listening, but I've got three kids. Have you got kids?
I've got a daughter. Yeah,
you've got a daughter, right? So, got three boys, and the fucking pick and mix, man. The price of that thing is insane. Like, I said to the kids, keep it light. I don't mean like they start talking about death in that. I mean, I just mean like, keep the bags light.
It's by weight, yeah.
It is by weight, yeah.
Maybe it's just that's why they're not understanding what you're saying.
No, they're just weird. A Crawley one, they just look at the bag and they go, that's £5. They don't weigh it. It's just like, there's such a strange way of doing it. It's like, yeah, that looks about... They just sort of Yoda it. It's so fucking mad. So, James, how are you? You good?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
What are you up to at the moment?
I'm working on a new TV show, doing some music.
Can you tell us about the TV show?
It's a new Idris Elba TV show.
Nice.
Yeah. I recently just did Trust, so that's playing on the BBC at the moment, which is a project I did with Danny Boyle.
Yeah.
And this documentary came out recently, Man From Mowax.
Yeah.
And just finishing a new record, so...
How do we watch the documentary, by the way?
Documentary is at cinemas at the moment, and a sort of limited theatrical run, but in London, I know there's a couple of screenings coming up. And as I noticed the other day, I'm on Sky.
Sky Store,
yeah. And Amazon, stuff like that, yeah.
Man From Mowax, can you just break it down to us? What exactly, like, what's your involvement? I mean, obviously I know that you're the founder of Mowax. What I mean is like...
Did you make it?
No, I didn't make it. It was quite a strange scenario. It started 10 years ago with my ex-wife, and it was meant to be a series of tour blog short films.
Right.
And it kind of escalated into a film from there, and then we parted ways, and the people she was working with, a co-director, and producer ended up sort of taking the film on. And it was one of those weird things because it went on for 10 years. I sort of never thought it was going to come out.
Right.
And a few years ago, they sort of finally presented this rough cut of the film for me to see. And the sort of realisation is that of it coming, you know, hit me. And so I sort of worked more with them, of giving them a quite a mad access to my personal library of video recordings over the last 25 right. years.
Is there anything you didn't want? Like when they presented it, you're like, I don't want that.
Yeah, there was
while he was making this record, yeah. He just couldn't stop tugging himself off. Yeah. So, probably don't want to include that.
You know, some things are left best to the imagination. there were things, and you know, but it's quite an interesting film. I suppose it's weird when it's something about yourself, but it's quite warts and all. So,
would you recommend it as like? Is it as like? Say, if somebody had no awareness of you, would that be a good introduction to what you're about?
I think so, yeah. To a degree. I mean, the thing is, it has a narrative and it builds on a certain period of certain periods of relationships, and it's very much based around the Mo Wax era and how that sort of changed over the last 20 years, and relationships with people like DJ Shadow and Giles Peterson and stuff like that, which is great. But that's sort of that's their perspective of my life, you know.
Right.
And it does go into a lot of other stuff, but I think that. If it was a purely creative journey, no. I think an element of one's personality, yes. And I think what it shows is sort of the madness of trying to make stuff and also being young in the record industry when I started, which was really exciting, but fucking mad as well.
You know? Yeah, yeah.
Because you were 18, weren't you?
I was 18 when I started the label, but I started working in record stores when I was 14.
Right.
So I started in a record store called Bluebird Records, which was on the Edgware Road. And that was like... about 89, and so it was kind of a great period of you know, the record shop was originally a kind of import record store. So, you know, when American dance records, disco records, house records, soul records, hip hop records would be sold, you know, you wouldn't be able to, they wouldn't be domestically released. So you'd go to these shops to buy American imports. And then you kind of had the rise as well of British electronic, you know, house, techno, hip hop as well. So 89 was an amazing year to experience and work in a record shop like that and experience all this amazing new music coming out.
Obviously passionate about music because you're working in a record store at 14 years old. Mm. How did that turn into you sort of getting involved in making music?
Well, I started there and I was, you know, I was DJing and that was my life and I it was what I wanted to do, and I did work experience basically from school. And then I ended up doing a Saturday job there and then basically sort of skiving off school as much as possible to work there. And then unfortunately it closed down and after I got my GCSEs, I went to a kind of business college, you know, right. Rather than doing A-levels. BTEC back then.
Oh, BTEC. Yeah,
business class BTEC. A joke
nice.
That was. But I had work experience again, and as Bluebird closed, I ended up getting a work experience in a record shop called Honest John's.
Yeah,
on Portobello Road, which is still there. And in those days, it was I started getting really into people like Giles Peterson, and also through hip hop, I was getting really into what records were being sampled and trying to find the original records. So Honest John's was this amazing record shop where you could buy old, predominantly black music. And what I did was start to bring new records in.
Right.
And that was the kind of beginning of my journey, really. And then I started writing. I was doing a couple of columns in Echoes, Blues and Soul, and The Face, doing sort of charts, DJ charts.
Yeah.
And I then managed to get a column in a magazine called Straight No Chaser.
Yeah.
And I called it Mo Wax Please, which was basically because at that time, in sort of 1991, the CDs were, you know, vinyl was being phased out by record labels. So Mo Wax Please was basically more records, please, you know. And I started reviewing a lot of records by people that records that weren't being released, getting a lot of demos. And I then started the label to basically start releasing records that nobody else was. And also I was, you know, there was a thing of sort of DJing in clubs and, you know, people had their record labels and, it, you know, so a lot of it was just about having exclusive material to DJ, really.
So you knew that you'd be able to drop those tunes and nobody
else. I mean, especially the big club, the big break, really for me was doing That's How It Is on a Monday Night with Giles Peterson.
Yeah.
And out of that club, you know, I did it. It lasted for, I think, about 11 or 12 years. And out of that, people like Ross Allen came out of that, and then Benji B. They were all the sort of, they were warm-up DJs. And, yeah. And it was an amazing time for records. So, you know, you had records from, you know, Higher State of Consciousness, Josh Wink being broken there, to The Roots were the in-house band at one point. To,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Amazing.
To, you know, Portishead, Massive Attack, Mo Wax, sort of. And yeah, it was literally, I think, originally for me, it was a bit of a competition that, you know, it was the acetate thing. So acetates, for those that don't know, is, you know, when you, like a dub, they're like dub plates, so you cut a record which is a one-off record, basically. And that was very, it kind of came from Jamaican sound system culture. And you make these records really to test records to then press them. But you can get a limited amount of plays out of an acetate, but it would mean you could have a one-off, you know, you could cut a track, an exclusive. And very much in those days, it was very much about dub plate culture.
Yeah.
And so, you know, every week you'd want to have something that the other DJ didn't have. And so it was a bit of a battle. You know, Giles had Talking Loud and I had Mo Wax. And so he'd be playing a new, you know, I don't know, Young Disciples record, and I'd be playing a new DJ Shadow record. And then eventually you'd give each other a test pressing.
Right.
You know, you know, you'd get the first TP, so you were still one of the first DJs and da da da. But I think in many ways it kind of just started from there. It wasn't the idea of necessarily what it became initially. You know, it was really just to sort of have records to put out to sort of within your gang, really. You know.
So you weren't thinking about, like, this is like a business, like, you're not Diddy going, like, I'm going to start the empire, or literally, like, this is going to help me have exclusives.
Yeah, what? Yeah. It was very much about DJing, you know. And then it grew from there, and then it became, you know, something else.
And that, was that just pure, was that organic, how that came about?
I think so. I mean, certain records, yeah, it was organic. I mean, I started putting out records which are a bit more jazz orientated and stuff, you know, because I was in that community and it was an opportunity for me to start what I was doing. But I think I was always really into hip hop, but also I'd grown up with, you know, a lot of, you know, the whole sort of later acid house, but more like the rave thing. So I was going out with my friends, you know, we all grew up in hip hop, but then suddenly you're in a field and, you know, wherever, off the M25, you know, dancing to these mad records, you know, and people like Carl Cox and stuff like that, DJing. And so I liked that, and I liked hip-hop. So I kind of wanted to, and I was, my favourite artists were artists like Massive Attack, the whole sound system sort of culture, Soul to Soul, and Smith and Mighty, and that's, so I wanted to kind of, when I started with friends, we started sort of doing these instrumental kind of hip-hop records that were sort of drawing from all these different elements. So they were quite soundtracky, because in weird ways, a lot of acid house sort of, you know, electronic records were quite sound, you know, had that sort of instrumental thing going on as well, and then taking, you know, elements of hip-hop and combining it. And so when that happened, it really, that's when things started sort of becoming a sound and an identity.
And how did Uncle come about?
Uncle came about because I started working with two producers who, a guy called Tosh and a guy called Kudo, who were from Japan. They were from a label that I love called Major Force. Major Force was the Japanese record label that started hip-hop in Japan. And they were part of the whole Red Alert posse. So they were part down with Jungle Brothers and the whole Native Tongues and stuff like that. And that was my favourite sort of group of hip-hop artists at the time. So I knew about them, and there was a record that came out on that label by a DJ called DJ Milo, who started the Wild Bunch, which then became Massive Attack. So the Wild Bunch was, you know, the members of Massive Attack that we know, like Daddy G and 3D and Mushroom, who's not there anymore, but was. But you had Nelly Hooper, who then went on to do Soul to Soul, and you had Milo, who then went up to Japan and was involved in Major Force. And there was this record that they did called The Return of the Original Art Form, which is arguably one of the greatest cut and paste instrumental hip hop records of all time. So similar to records like Mantronic's King of the Beats. And I got exposed to their label through Tim Simenon, who was Bomb the Bass, because he used to come to Blue Blood Records with a guy called Michael Copperman, who ran Stussy in the UK, and then two brothers, Alex and Johnny, who had a crew called Ronin. and they were really big. They were Stussy Crew, and they were big UK hip hop DJs. And I got given these records, and the design and the whole thing is, I liked kind of finding international records that people wouldn't know. And a lot of it was about, you know, the raps weren't that good, but the instrumentals were great.
So right,
like James Brown cut up, kind of really well produced, but the imagery was amazing. So I got into this label, and I was also, before I went to Bluebird, at that period of time, I was really into martial arts. So I originally started coming to London to do Kung Fu.
Right.
And hip-hop and Kung Fu was pretty synonymous, you know? And so that's how I discovered a lot of hip-hop records, was from going at an early age. I started martial arts when I was 8. And that's how I really, one of the ways I discovered that style of music. So I sort of had an instant sort of thing of getting Japanese records. And so then when I went to Honest John's, one of the things I'd do to get really collectible records that I was looking for, because we were selling collectible records, so whether it be a rare jazz record or funk record, you know, it was one of the best places in the country to go. The irony is that most of the records were coming from America, but you'd get American hip-hop producers coming to the shop to buy the records.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. So, and other artists from all over the world. So suddenly these two guys come in from Japan, they're asking for this rare jazz record. And I said, look, I can get you that record. And they're like, how much? I'm like, I don't want money. I want these Major Force records. And they're like, oh, okay. Who are you looking for? I was like, I want this Tycoon Tosh record. And they just started laughing. And I said, what? And they're like, the guy goes, I am Tycoon Tosh. And so I basically struck up a relationship with them, and I persuaded them to let me go in the studio with them. And,
right.
And I started doing Major Force in the UK. And basically, I went into studio to make a record, and I made this record. And it was the Uncle record.
Right,
and
right,
Uncle
right.
was like a production thing. You know, again, in sort of hip-hop, everybody had their kind of production. You know, what I loved about hip-hop at that period, and it still exists now, but because we're not in a physical format of records, is that when you got an album, you'd look at the back and there'd be... Hip-hop records would always have amazing, like, logos. It'd be like Rush Productions or,
yeah.
you know, whatever, Native Tongues or Red Alert Productions. So when I did the Straight No Chaser column, I was working with Swifty, who is the graphic designer that designed Straight No Chaser and Talking Loud. And I just got all these logos sort of created of imaginary things. So I started Uncle Productions.
Right.
And you'd have the logo in the magazine and do T-shirts. And so when it came to put a record out, I was like, oh, we'll just do it as an Uncle record. Which I regret to this day calling it that. But anyway, there you go. And I started. So I made a record with Tosh and Kudo, and then and I released that on.
So when was that? That was
God, early 90s, about 92.
Right. Okay.
Around then. So there you go. That's the how it all started. It's Tosh and Kudo.
What were you doing at 14 to 18? I feel like I've achieved nothing listening to that.
I've got to be honest. You do have a
I've
way
got
of
some
making
regrets.
You do have a way of making people feel like frauds. Like, when I was 14, what was I doing? I was trying just to
set up a label.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I was trying to do something other than wanking, I think, was sort of my main sort of aim. The thing that is sort of comes across from listening to you talk about how it all started is that, like, when you hear about people, like, you know, we've had a little bit of experience of having, like, rappers or producers in here and, like, bands and stuff, and they talk about doing their music, but everything that you're talking about is nowhere do you say, we thought this would be popular, or, you know, or you're trying to go for this. You've just, everything
Loved
you've
it.
Done is driven by your taste, do you know what I mean? Because when Uncle sort of came out, like, you sort of go, I don't know, I can't quite put my finger on what this is. Do you know what I mean? I know it's great and I know I really like it, but, like, it's so ahead of its time. You know, people almost have to get their heads around it, and that's because, and when I listen to you talk about the origins of it, it all makes sense of how it all feels very organic, how it came together. But none of that is driven by, you don't know if anybody's got a taste for that or whatever. You're just going, this is what I like, I'm going to make
that.
Yeah,
I mean, I suppose the taste for it was your community, and everything was very community driven. So at that time, it was all about going to the clubs and the people you were hanging out with. And really, it was just about, I suppose, in a vulgar way, showing off to your mates.
Yeah, right. Okay.
You know? And I wasn't the cool kid. You know, I wasn't that. I was, you know, I was from Oxford. I didn't grow up in London. You know, I was always younger than everybody at the time. And I suppose I had to prove more than most you know, or I felt I did.
Yeah.
So I just had, I don't know, it's weird. Like, you know, even when I think back to that time, I can't remember quite a lot. But also, I don't know who that is. I'm a very different, in one way, I'm a very different person, but it's, I don't know who that, you know, how or why, but there was just this drive to sort of do stuff and, yeah, and take it all in. And I was very fortunate that through various circumstances, I met just this amazing community of people who have now gone on to be part of, a lot of them have sort of become massively important in contemporary culture, whether it be in clothing or design or music or whatever. It's that weird thing, isn't it, of how, you know, you hear these stories of people being at school together and, you know, you know, there's that, like that school in Roehampton where all the, you know, the XX and Fortet and you know, Burial all came out of, you know, it's weird, but this sort of small community, and really for me it was just about, you were just engaging with that. So for me, it was like on the higher level, it would be a, you know, a Giles Peterson or a Tim Westwood or a, you know, a Daddy G or whatever. Those were the sort of OGs, and you'd be trying to get them to play your records. And that was enough. That, you know, to me, the one of the greatest moments of my life was one, getting a first test pressing of a record you made, but hearing somebody like a Giles or a DJ like that play it on Kiss FM or something.
Yeah.
That was like, oh my God. And it was small, but there was a massive, but it was, I think, because we live in a different world now where it's social media and da-da-da, that, you know, things are very sporadic and spread out. Whereas then, you know, you know, it was very much about, if you didn't, you know, you engage with the community because that was everything, you know, it was your world, that was how to create your identity, that was a language, it was very much going to the clubs was a very, very, not that it isn't a social thing now, but it was very, that was the social way. You know, now we've got so many ways to go out and entertain ourselves. You know, you can just do it on computer, you can watch a movie at home on a dollar, but actually you kind of had to go out and engage to sort of meet people, etc. And through that, you know, you found your identity, but also it kind of how you contributed to that place.
Yeah.
You know, everybody kind of that was in those clubs one way or another was sort of contributing in some way or another.
Do you think the way that it is now means that you're less likely to see kind of different stuff happen in music and stuff like that? Like, you know, because everybody's so social media savvy and stuff like that.
I think it's just different. It's a different environment. Do you know what I mean? You know, like, you know, record stores. So to work in a record store those days, for me, I suppose that my confidence came from the fact that when you worked in a record store and you had the best records, you've got to remember that the DJs playing those records were like gods. But if they didn't get the record, they weren't going to smash it that night. They weren't going to get laid. They weren't going to get, you know, it's way more than music on the line here. Do you know what I mean? You know, it's status, everything. So, you know, and you're trading with that and you're engaging with that. And that scene was, you know, record shops and clubs were, those were the only places you could go to experience certain things. You know, you don't go to a record store now. And, you know, when I was selling records, you'd have on a Saturday, there'd be, you know, you could have a 30 people deep, you know, and you know, people, you play a record and everybody would raise their hands to get the record. You'd have people fighting over a record. You'd have people threatening you because they didn't get the record. And that created a certain atmosphere, which was an electric atmosphere. You know, the only way that you could hear those records was in a club. You weren't hearing it on radio.
No.
You know, so if you wanted to hear the records, you had to go to the club, you had to go to the record
store.
Now you can hear it on Spotify. You can get pretty much anything. You know, records don't, you know, you don't have exclusive periods necessarily for records anymore. You know, a DJ could get a record, that DJ could have it for 3 months on his own. Then other DJs would get it and they'd have it for 6 months and then it would come out. And there was just something about that, whereas now everything's instant and you can get it on any other platform. But that also changes things. There are positive things about that as well. But it's a different kind of community.
Yeah.
So I think there's so many things that have changed the way, you know, and are different from when I started. But that's just, I suppose, that's progress, folks.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Hey, Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rack your brains. Give it some thought. What was the first hip-hop album you bought?
With regards to hip-hop, like your, what do you remember what your first kind of hip-hop album that you really sort of blown away
by? Yeah,
from?
I mean, it's funny. So Top of the Pops was, you know, there was a combination of Top of the Pops seeing things like Grandmaster Flash for the first time, and then going to my second school and walking to the school hall and hearing Electro and people in Tashini tracksuits and Puma Dallas, and hearing really sort of early hip-hop and Electro, and just, it was like science fiction, you know. I can't explain, you know, because really, otherwise, it was kind of quite drab rock, and it was also a lot of artists from the 70s who were making records in the 80s, you know, which was not interesting when you're 13, 12, you know, to identify with. Or, and it was very nostalgic. I was that little bit too young for the two-tone thing, so I missed that. And it was just like, it was science fiction. It was like seeing something from another planet, especially growing up in England, which was, I always think that growing up in England in the late 70s, early 80s was like black and white.
Yeah.
Everything was grey. Food was grey, you know, the weather was particularly grey.
Yeah.
The buildings, everything was fucking grey.
Yeah.
And America, you saw this stuff coming from America first, and it was like everybody turned on to Technicolor, you know. And seeing something like Planet Rock or Grandmaster Flash on Top of the Pops was just like, what the fuck? It was like, it was literally like seeing, you know, like seeing something like Blade Runner for the first time, And then I got into just starting to get, you know, really at that age, it was tapes. It wasn't even records, you know. They were much easier to steal as well.
Yeah.
You know? And so it was getting early hip-hop albums like Grandmaster, sort of Melly Mel records. But the records that kind of probably were the first things that I started buying were things like Street Sounds compilations. Street Sounds was a label run by a guy called Morgan Kahn, and he basically took all these amazing American 12-inches, which were all predominantly being released on independent labels. So they weren't getting released generally in the UK. And if they were, they were coming out a year later or 2 years later.
Right.
It was like movies. Now you go and see a movie, the movie comes out the same day worldwide.
As you're leaving, yeah.
When we were kids, you know, Star Wars would come out 6 months later in England, you know. So he was getting all this stuff first and putting them together on compilations, and he was a very good curator in that way. And those were the best ways of getting all this amazing music. So Street Sounds, you know, early hip-hop records, things, and then you're getting things like Schoolie D, Cormo D records. And then really for me, I think when it really kind of went, when it just was like, bang, was, you know, De La Soul, 3 Feet Home Rising.
Right, yeah.
NWA, you know, Straight Outta Compton, records like that. That was when it, you know, Public Enemy.
Yeah, boy! Bass, how low can you go? Death Row, what a brother, no. Once again, back is the incredible rhyme animal, the uncannibal beast. Public Enemy number one. 5-4 said freeze, and I got numb. Can I tell them that I really never had a gun? But it's the wax that the Terminator X bun.
Those records kind of...
I think Public Enemy, Nation of Millions, was the one that got me. But I really relate to your thing of going... The first time I heard it, I was just like, what the fuck is this, man? Do you know, it wasn't like, oh, this is catchy. You just like, I can't even process it. Do you know what I mean? It just sounded so mad.
The sound was mad, but it was also visually, man. You know, it was like, you know, you see something like Public Enemy, it was like pretty fucking amazing.
I know.
You know, just these what people forget, you know, because hip-hop is so... You know, the culture of hip hop then was slightly different. It was very all encompassing in the sense that it wasn't just about the records. It was, you were seeing things. You were the language. You know, just hearing somebody say "yo,"
yeah.
You'd be like, it was like, your mum's gonna fucking hate you. Great, yo. You know what I mean? Like, can you speak the proper English? You know, I grew up in middle class North Oxford. My mum was horrified hearing, my sort of trying to act like American rappers, you know. But it was just everything, and the things like Public Enemy, Def Jam, and Sleeping Bag. It was the baseball jacket. It was Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah.
Can you remember that?
Yes,
when he's got the best baseball jacket.
Yeah,
and you're
just
like, that was the first time.
Mate,
like,
I looked for that.
I want that. Yeah, you just want
Isn't
that jacket,
just
right?
Isn't that just loving American things?
Yeah.
That's what I was like.
Yeah.
But it was also a street thing, I think. Because there was, the American thing also, different generations, was the punk thing and the kind of, there were different musical strains, the sort of post-punk stuff as well. But hip-hop, to me, you had... It was also a culture of thing people coming together. My mother's sister married an Indian man, so my cousins were mixed race. So I was growing up with that, but that was also kind of finding its feet and coming together, especially with youth culture. So to sort of experience this amazing kind of cultural thing and also this sort of predominantly black movement, but it kind of spoke to you in such an incredible way that everything felt so new. So I think it was just this kind of, it was like seeing a movie when you saw those artists. And it could just be like, literally just, again, because you're in an era where you could only maybe see it once a week.
I mean, I do think that made it so much more special because like, you're sort of...
Trying to hunt it down.
Yeah, because like, as soon as like, if you saw Public Enemy on like a mainstream show or something...
Yeah.
You'd just be like, fucking, I can't believe
because
it.
Because everything else was so shit as well.
Yeah, yeah.
You're like, and it was that era where suddenly you've got Mick Jagger doing bad records. And then, you've got, obviously there's a lot of good, kind of good electro synth records, but that wasn't what hit me. I think it was naughty, it was bad, it was dangerous as well. There was a danger to it. And all of that stuff coming together, I think, as a kid was just like, especially a boy, was like, it was everything you can ask for, There was a thing, feeling of trying to find a voice because that you didn't really, when you were younger, when I grew up, and I was relatively privileged. My mother was an artist. My father was a lawyer, but he was a musician. So, and I came from a very open-minded household. But the way that I was probably going was to follow probably more of an academic middle class North Oxford route.
Right.
And then hip hop, well, first it was martial arts and then hip hop. And the combination of that was the perfect way to just do any parent's head in at that point in time.
Yeah.
And also to find a kind of a new identity. It was a whole new way of communicating within youth culture.
And were you more tuned into the rappers or the production or was it
all of it?
Right.
I mean, I was always very obsessive. Maybe it came from, I don't know what it... I sort of trace it back to my parents, and my father was very into... He's a brilliant sort of musicologist, and he's also... He studied Greek and Latin classics, and he can recite Dante in Latin. He's got one of those brains of history and...
You got that in your locker, right?
Handy, yeah.
But he's one of those guys that has this very obsessive but meticulous brain about whatever he's into. And I kind of got that, I think, from my father. So I became very obsessive about... things. When I got into martial arts, I was going to study in Shaolin in China, and I was learning Chinese at sort of 12, 13, and studying every day and coming to London.
Are you just coming to make us feel like shit about ourselves?
No. Okay, all right.
No, it's good.
But I got obsessive about hip hop, So I got into everything from the production to the labels, and I just tried to just consume as much as possible and sort of, but that took over everything. That was my life was just dedicated. So my school life fell apart, but I was going to, I remember when I got one school report, the sports teacher said, yes, we hear he's a nice guy, but he's never been to sports. My mum freaking out going, I thought you were going to sports. I was like going to London to get records. And so I just studied everything and I became very obsessed. So I loved all of it, every facet of it, from the visual identity, which was predominantly graffiti, and to the language, to the production, to who the crews were. That was also one of the great things about vinyl, or not just vinyl, but way records were packaged back in the days. You had all this, it was the only way to get the information, and you'd have a few magazines, and then you might get a few pirate radio shows, and you sort of pieced it all together, and it became this sort of archaeological quest to find things,
Yeah.
And through that, then that became this amazing journey of how you met people and stuff. But yeah, I just became obsessive about all of it.
It's interesting you bring up the visuals, because like, I do think logos are such a thing for like the Wu-Tang W is like...
Or just Def Jam, man. You know, yeah, Tommy of course, Boy, yeah, you know. Yeah. They're extraordinary, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and very much part of modern culture now, you know, in the same way that, you know, you've got kind of Coca-Cola, but hip-hop was brilliant at branding.
It feels
like it was the first really that branded itself, rather than it being just about the artist. It was about crews, posses,
communities.
And you had the DJ, you had the breakdancer, you had the artist, and everybody came together. And you see, and that's something that I think is very much a foundation of how modern sort of contemporary culture works.
Hey, man, what's your favourite hip-hop album?
We always ask what your favourite hip-hop album of all time is.
It's a difficult one. Yeah. But it's difficult and it's not, because actually, at certain periods, there weren't great hip-hop albums, so were great hip-hop singles.
Right.
You know, but then the 90s, I think, just sort of 88 onwards, the albums started to get more crafted. For me, the record that I probably played the most and was the most exciting record personally to ever hear was Low End Theory, Tribe Called Quest.
Yo, microphone check, 1, 2, what is this? The 5'7" with the roughneck business. I float like gravity, never had a cavity. Got more rhymes than the one that's got family. No need to sweat Arsenio to gain some type of fame. No shame in my game, cause I always be the same. Styles upon styles upon styles is what I have. You want to just decipher, but you still don't know the half.
It's a pop. Was that Clara's as well?
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah.
And what is it about that one? Because obviously Tribe are incredible, but what is it about Low End Theory above any of the
others? It was just everything about it. You know, I mean, but I mean, the production was just on another level.
Was it all Q-Tip?
It was Q-Tip and Ali Shaheed. But I think, you know, Q-Tip was obviously incredibly instrumental in most of it. Bob Power mixed it. The mixes were incredible. It was an album. It had a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Mm.
It is also the choice of sampling was just unreal. Mm. And you know, I was at that period. I was very much into the sort of jazz, soul, and funk thing. So that record just kind of worked with anything. You know, every hip hop head was into it, but you could play it in every other kind of club. And you know, Q-Tip was just the man.
He
was just, you know, him, Rakim, you know, those were the two that really were my favourite rappers of those years.
You know, with sampling, because like Tribe and I think De La Soul as well, the way they use samples was actually, it was still complex and nuanced and stuff. And that is a different type of sampling to where somebody just rips off a catchy kind of riff or something and then just loops it.
Yeah, and also a lot of the records the other thing is now you can get things very instantly, but a lot of the records that they were finding, I mean, Prince Paul was unreal on that level. I mean, you know, three is the magic number. That record is like a kind of, it's a Sesame Street kind of kids record.
Yeah.
And, you know, you couldn't find it. I mean, these records were impossible to find. So there was an element of these god-like people that were putting these records together from these samples that were like, how did you... You know, so you'd spend years just trying to find the samples, you know. And I'd actually say that the other record that I think... You know, there's three records from that period. You know, Tribe is... That record, Low End Theory, is my favourite, I think, hip-hop record of all time. But 3 Feet High and Rising is also is an extraordinary record in that way.
Difficult preaching is posthumous pleasure. Pleasure in preaching starts in the heart. Something that stimulates the music in a measure. Measure in the music, raising 3 parts. Casually see, but don't do like the soul. Cause seeing and doing are actions for monkeys. Doing hip-hop, hustle, no rock and roll. Unless your name's Brewster, cause Brewster's a punk.
And N.W.A. Straight Outta Compton, I thought, as albums. But I just think that, you know, the Tribe just sort of... It was fucking cool. They were just cool. And it was the New York thing as well. New York, it was, you know, it really, hip-hop was so New York-centric in that way.
What do you feel about, do you ever take on like the legacy of Straight Outta Compton? Because like Straight Outta Compton was an amazing record. It did sort of push hip-hop, or a certain section of hip-hop, into that kind of area of kind of extreme, you know, that whole gangster rap thing.
Yeah, but it had existed before. I mean, I think a lot of people focus on N.W.A., but Ice-T was...
Doing
that a lot before. And then you had people like Schoolie D, Cool G Rap.
Yeah.
It was synonymous with, you know, these records predominantly coming out the street. And, you know, and you know, look at what those the places that most of those artists were coming from were like back in those days. It was pretty hardcore. So yeah. Rap being essentially an expression of life, you know, I think that it was real. I think now a lot of it is bullshit. It makes for a good story.
Yeah.
You know, but I think for those guys, it was really expressing what you were seeing around you. And also, you know, there was how you funded those records. Record companies weren't funding you. Mm. And if you were being funded by a record company, they were pretty dodgy anyway. So you were paying through it from other means. And those other means generally were kind of quite dodgy, you know, selling drugs or whatever, you know, that was it. And so I think whilst it kind of records like that are responsible for certain things, I think in the integrity of that record is what's important and what it says. It wasn't fake, it was real.
Yeah.
And again, it was very exciting to hear that, even though for a lot of people what their experiences were are pretty shit, you know, when you look at what, you know, Compton and what was going on and in that period of time, and especially the racism, which is obviously ongoing, but at that time was horrific with police, etc. And incredibly poor. I think that those, you know, so I sort of see it as they weren't trying to kind of, it wasn't like they were going out to be like, we're going to shock everybody
just to do this. Yeah.
I think there was an element of that, but I think that's part of being a music. You know, there's always an element of, it doesn't matter if you're in a rock band, you know, the Rolling Stones want to shock people,
yes,
you know.
Yeah.
It's part of entertainment, right? But I think that, so, you know, I think that those records in particular, you know, a record like NWA is very important socially, but also the thing that's really great about NWA Out of Compton is it's such a brilliantly made record.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
And again, has brilliant samples.
Are you still as into hip hop as you always have been, or have you sort of?
Yeah, I am. I don't collect it in the same way that I used to physically. I'm not as aware of, you know, because obviously hip hop, it has so many different strands now. In the sense, it's the most commercial music in the, you know, it's the biggest selling
the
music
biggest,
in the world.
Yeah.
But then on the other end, you've got, you know, your kind of SoundCloud rappers and everything. And to take it all in, I'm just not on it in that way anymore. But yeah, I mean, I love hip hop still. And
what are you listening to at the moment?
Well, I'm always fascinated by the sort of Kanye saga, you know.
Are you a Kanye fan?
I'm a fan of his production.
Right.
I think he's a brilliant producer, and I think he's a brilliant sort of cultural magpie and eccentric. I'm not into the vomit.
Right.
I think the problem we have, the other thing that's very different, actually going back to the old days of when I started, which is mad thinking it's the old days, I always thought I was the youngest, now I'm like really old, but is that there was a filter system.
Yeah.
And there's not a filter system so much anymore.
Yeah.
And that means there's a lot of records, so if you want to be an expert on something, it's pretty insane, because
yeah.
there's just endless, it doesn't matter what kind of music,
no,
you know, but when it comes to something like Kanye, there's no stop button. And that's sometimes the problem, I think. Well, it is a problem, you know.
Him thinking of something and being able to broadcast that immediately is an issue for him, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
it's not the issue that, you know, we can all do that, but it's the filter system thing. It's not thinking about what you're doing, but that's what we can at times get fascinated by. But I'm actually predominantly I really like his production. I think he's a brilliant producer, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of the other stuff, especially his politics, you know, it's sad because it's entertaining, but it's also, you forget the power of what it's being done.
But is
he
doing that to be shocking? I mean, we're talking about,
I think so, yeah, because
I think,
you know, look, I'm not a social media person. I've never had Facebook. You know, I have Uncle Facebook and da-da. I've never had Instagram. I've never done it personally.
Yeah.
So I don't.
Is that a deliberate decision, or you just haven't been asked?
Yeah, kind of.
Right.
Well, it was kind of, I'm just quite private about things.
Yeah.
In a certain way, even though you've got a film coming out, which is really unprivate. But but in a certain way, yeah. And I think at the time when things exploded with social media, I was definitely in a bit of a reclusive period. So going back to somebody like Kanye, I think that it's also it's a modern way of expressing yourself, isn't it? How you utilise social media in the way of somebody like him or that clan that he's part of, you know.
Yeah.
But I think with him there is probably also issues of sort of mental health and stuff like that, not being negative, where it's sort of like you're not being filtered, and maybe sometimes you should have somebody just watching your back.
You do think somebody at that level,
because you are watching a reality TV
show. Yeah, it's fucking
take away
mad.
His Twitter.
Yeah. Well, just somebody just go to just somebody that he goes to and goes, I'm about to say that slavery is a choice.
Yeah.
Could I just double check with you that that's okay to say? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, or whatever. Like, it's just...
Or get your facts of how to articulate it.
Well,
right.
that is the thing.
Because he will then always say, well, I didn't mean that.
Yeah.
I wanted to say this. But obviously there are certain things that you need to think about. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, when you I saw the Jay-Z Letterman interview that I had on Netflix not too long ago, that is a very... He considered things incredibly well.
Yeah.
And I thought was incredibly mindful to certain things, actually, you know, especially...
Well,
his...
Letterman tried to push him on the whole infidelity thing.
But he was mindful about it.
Yeah.
He was. He did express it. He did talk about it, and he wasn't a dick about it.
No.
You know.
It felt like, and I'm sure that wasn't the case, but it felt like Letterman could have said anything to him. And he would have had. He would have just filled. You know.
Yeah,
filled
I think he was just mindful about the way he reacted. I was pretty impressed. But I think that's also where you get to the level of somebody like that.
Yeah.
You know. And then other hip hop artists, I very spread it. I quite like. I sort of got into kind of. There's quite a lot of new sort of more indie stuff that I like. You know, there's interesting stuff happening with British hip hop. You know. So there's sort of. I sort of take bits. Fragments of stuff and put it together, you know.
Mm.
But that's also, my whole process has always been a sort of collage and sampling, so I'm constantly taking bits and pieces. But the thing is, I wouldn't say I'm an expert anymore on... I'm not an expert on contemporary hip-hop.
Well, none of us are.
Whereas I would say that I was pretty good expert on 90s, you know.
Yeah.
The beginnings of hip-hop to probably about 2001. It kind of ends... 2001 Chronic is sort of where it kind of ended as... The obsession of hip hop.
Right.
But it's weird because I'm not buying records in the same way, you know, like my memory of what things are. You get asked these questions, what do you like at the moment? And I'm like, I can't remember.
Yeah.
I know when I get home and I've put it on a folder, I've written it all down, because I have a radio show. Which I'll plug my radio show.
Yes,
Living in my headphones on Soho Radio.
Okay.
But it's just quite sporadic. I'm constantly listening to radio shows and randomly just hearing records and writing them down. And then from friends, from walking around, from watching things, I'm just constantly sort of sampling records, you know, in my head, taking these bits.
Plug one, plug two, guest plugs for you.
James, listen, we are out of time, unfortunately, but you have been an incredible guest. Would you be up for coming back on?
I'd love to, yeah.
We'd love to have you back on and do it, because I'll tell you why. One of the reasons is I could tell Rupert's excited. He's asked more questions during this episode than he has during the 2 years total that we've been doing
it. Yeah, I was going to tell you my story when I saw Shadow and Crush in Manchester in 1994. It's like one of my favourite sort of hip-hop related.
Where was that? Like Sankey's? Yeah, I was there. God damn it, you didn't fucking remember me, did you? Right, interview's over now.
What a dreadful... do you know what? We're wrapping this up in a beautiful way.
You're going to tell
my story that doesn't fucking involve you.
That was an amazing, incredible. But I think that was maybe one of the first bugged outs or one of those things very early, like the first month of Sankey Cypher.
I found it this morning online. Someone's got a recording of it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that whole set.
And they're DJing together.
Yeah.
Wow. That would have been really good records, I think.
Yeah. I see that. Yeah.
But it sums up perfect 90s. Like, it's perfect 90s playlist.
I'd like to hear that. Well, you know what? When I come back, send it to me. Yeah. And I'd absolutely love to. Yeah. I'd really love to.
Okay. We'd love Tony back. I've never seen him like this. Honestly, James.
I've never
seen him like this.
It's like, I've remembered everything.
Listen, it's been such a pleasure to have you on. So we can see your film in selected cinemas,
and then it's out on DVD. And you can, you know, the most of the sort of download platforms, i.e., Amazon, you know, iTunes. And Sky, you can watch
it. Download.
Yeah.
Okay, good. You said it really in a really sinister way, but it's good that you're going to do that.
There's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, it's really creepy the way you did it, but it's good. James, listen, we look forward to part two. Thank you so much for your time, man.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, man.
Cheers.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.